really going to discuss in great detail the patriarchal history, only because we're going to cover those individuals in some length at some future point in our study in Genesis. So it really, just so that you see it on the sheet, you have an idea of where I'm coming from, and we'll elaborate on that as we talk about those individuals. I do want to spend most of the night talking about the Babel crisis, or the Tower of Babel. And I think there's some things that are there that really are pretty misunderstood, but on the same token are important for us to understand. And I want to start in Genesis 6, ironically, which is something we looked at in some detail last week. But in Genesis 6, and the first four verses, if we could maybe read those. Genesis 6, verses 1 through 4.
And it came to pass, when men began to multiply in the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. And the Lord said, My spirit shall not always strive with man, and that he also is flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men, which were of old men of renown.
Okay, I wanna look at this word giants for a second. Okay? Septuagint. Which is a Greek translation of the Old Testament. It would be the word Gerasco, or I mispronounced it. Geherasco would be the way it would be pronounced. And literally,
that's Greek.
That would be Greek. It also is the same idea with the word eros in the same verse. Okay.
The same word is translated two different ways?
Right. The word heroes, and the word has multiple meanings. Okay. It can mean fearless.
The spelling for that?
Yeah. It's G-E-R-A-S-K-O. In Greek, in Hebrew, it would be Gibor. G-I-B-B-O-R. And it literally can mean giant in height. It can mean giant in accomplishment, or it can mean tyrannical, it can mean fearless, it can mean hero. It has all of those meanings attached to it. And sometimes in scripture it'll be translated as hero, or renown in the King James.
It's a positive connotation.
It's a positive connotation, maybe, not necessarily. Fearless is a better rendering to it, but it has those meanings to it. Now, why would I start here? Well, in Genesis 6, we see that there's a rebellion that's going on that God dealt with via the flood. And what you have is angelic beings that have left their first estate, joining themselves to the daughters of man in a sexual union to eradicate the idea of a seed coming. And we looked at that in some detail last week. And trust me, this has a lot to do with Babel when we get there. So we see all of this, and there's this idea of giants and heroes. There's also, if we go down in the text, some other things that are important for us to just kind of read and have in our hearing. If you want to look, for instance, at verse 11, somebody could read that.
The earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with fire.
Okay, the phrase before God. Keep that in your thinking. I want to come up with a definition of what that means. It, again, the word itself is in the Hebrew, it's pen ayamni, P-E-N-I-Y-M-N. In Hebrew, in the Septuagint, it would be inanition, E-N-A-N-T-I-O-N. And literally, what that word means, and it's another one of those words that can have multiple meanings. It can mean to be in front of somebody. For instance, Lillian is before me. In other words, she's in front of me and I see her. It can mean to be above somebody. For instance, the Lord is before all of us. In other words, he's the foremost, is that idea of it. It can also mean the idea of defiance.
That of Antichrist.
Right. For instance, in Genesis 6:11, it has the idea here of defiance. The idea is that the earth was filled with violence, right? But if you read the whole thing, Rotherham renders it this way. And the earth corrupted itself before God. You could render it just as easily, and the earth corrupted itself in defiance of God. That would be a good rendering. Earth was filled with violence. So the idea is that the word before can have that meaning of defiance.
I call waiting.
Okay. So it has that meaning to it. Let me go to another place. Exodus 7. Exodus chapter 7 in verse 10. This 7:10. Somebody could read that.
And Moses and Aaron went in unto Pharaoh, and they did so as the Lord had commanded. And Aaron cast down his rod before Pharaoh and before his servants, and it became a serpent.
Okay. The International Standard Version renders it this way. And it would say where they cast the rod before Pharaoh, it renders it in defiance of Pharaoh. And I think defiance fits. It's not a stretch to take it that way. Pharaoh has a line of thinking that's contrary to God, and they're in defiance to that way of thinking. And the word does have that connotation with it. So it kind of opens up a little bit of the thing. I'm part of the reason why Pharaoh was so angry at Moses, because Moses is defying his authority, because he's recognizing a different authority. So there's that idea there.
It brings out the drama of the whole thing.
It does. And I think it's actually a better rendering than the word before there. In chapter 8 of Exodus, you'll see the same idea. And there's literally dozens of verses you can go to, but I just took a few here. Exodus 8 and verse 20. Somebody could read that.
Let Moses rise up early in the morning and stand before Pharaoh. Let say to him, thus saith God, let my people go, that they may serve me.
Okay. Now, and again, that word before Pharaoh could be rendered in defiance of Pharaoh. I want you to defy Pharaoh, is the idea. I want you to be in opposition to him. I want you to be resisting him.
In his face.
In his face. Yep. Face to face, I want you to openly resist. Because I'm going to do a great work through you to show where the true power lies. But the only way I can demonstrate it is for you to defy Pharaoh. Okay? We'll see the same idea in Numbers. If you want to go with me to the book of Numbers, chapter 14.
It's kind of a private thing. Just
right.
Before you know, nobody's going to be around this early in the morning by the water.
Right. In that rendering, in that account of what's happening in that particular plague, it's a very private thing. And it's giving Pharaoh the chance to save face by doing it privately. Numbers chapter 14, and if you want to look at verse 37, somebody could read that.
Even those men that did bring up the evil report upon the land died by the plague before the Lord.
Okay. It could just as easily be rendered, they died by the plague being in defiance to the Lord. They were defying his authority because he had given them the command to do what?
Okay.
To take the land. And they were defying his command. You know, to go out and scout the land, that's a good thing. No problem with that. But when they come back and resist what God has said because they're afraid, interestingly enough, it involved giants, right? And they didn't want to go into the land before that, it was in defiance of the command God had given. So that word has that connotation with it. To be in defiance before. And we have to remember that word has that connotation with it, because we're going to see it again in Genesis, and later on in the book of Genesis, in reference to Babel. And there's a defiance of God that's going on with Babel. So what we've established so far, you can go back into Genesis, the early part of Genesis. What we've established so far is that in Genesis 6, there's this rebellion that had taken place. God had a judgment against that rebellion through the flood. The rebellion involved angelic beings who kept not their first estate, commingled with the children of men, in particular daughters of man, and what it produced was a hybrid being. King James renders it as giants. Some translations will render it as heroes. Same word. And literally these individuals were men of fearlessness. They were in defiance to God. And the whole earth or the whole land had defied God, thus bringing judgment upon itself. The only ones who were not involved in that rebellion, obviously, were Noah and his three sons, their three wives, and his wife. So you have this idea. Now, last week, we kind of left it where we really didn't address in detail, well, where did these beings come back again? Because Genesis 6:4, we looked at, in some detail, and we saw again that and even after that there were these beings that would come after the flood of Noah, that these hybrid beings again would come upon the face of the earth. And we saw, for instance, in Numbers. So the question is, does Scripture give us a point where this occurred again?
Yeah.
He was. He's one.
Not a hybrid.
Well,
offspring.
He's an offspring.
An offspring of a hybrid?
Right. He's an offspring of a hybrid, is the way to look at it. Yeah. The offspring of a hybrid. But yes, he's the result of that rebellion. And I wanna look for a few minutes on where I think it took place. Any guess that it's the Tower of Babel?
Where what took place?
Where the rebellion started up again, where man tried to do the same thing. While we're there, I just want to look, before you go to Genesis, later on, I gave you a handout on sheets. We'll go to that sheet.
No, no, because the man tried to do the same thing again?
Reinstitute that rebellion by appealing to the angelic realm to come into, again, start up that attempt at recreating a different race of beings.
Would they have remembered it?
Well, I'm sure they would have, because I'm sure that history would have passed it down from Noah. It would have been a big event in Noah's life, having seen it, and his sons' lives, and their daughters, and their wives. You know, so I think that it really was a big thing where they could look at it. If you want to look here at verse 13 of Genesis 6 for a second. Tyrant hero. Okay? throughout the land. He became a fearless hunter. I want to stop and look at this word hunter for a few minutes. Okay? Now the word hunter is interesting. It's the Hebrew word Sayid. It's T-S-A-Y-I-D. And I want to show another place where this word is used. Somebody wants to take Jeremiah 16:16. Jeremiah 16 in verse 16.
Behold, I will send for many fishers, says the Lord, and they shall fish them. After will I send for many hunters, and they shall hunt them from every mountain and from every hill and out of the holes of the rocks.
Question, it's the word hunt in that passage, obviously. Now, what are they hunting in Jeremiah? People. It's the idea of the word. One who hunts people.
Bounty hunter.
Well, possibly. Souls is a better way to look at it. They're the hunter of souls. It's who Nimrod is. He's the greatest in the history of mankind, or one of, at the time he lived at least, at hunting the souls of who? Men. We're getting to that. Okay. Let's continue down in the passage, verse 10. In the beginning of his kingdom was one.
Back in Genesis?
Genesis 10. At the beginning of his kingdom was Babel or Babylon. Okay. And then it mentions a couple of other places, Erech and Akkad and Telna, in the land of where?
China.
So where is he? He's in a place called China. Okay?
Persia.
Okay, now this kingdom, the beginning of his kingdom, is in this area. Go with me to Genesis, or Daniel. Keep your hand in Genesis. Daniel. And chapter 1, verse 1. Daniel 1, verse 1. And if somebody could read Daniel 1, verse 1, that would be wonderful.
In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, when Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and deceived.
Okay, so you have Nebuchadnezzar comes. Where's he from?
Babylon.
Okay. Now, as we continue down, verse 2, somebody could read that.
And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God, and brought the vessels unto the treasure house of his God.
So the idea is that Nebuchadnezzar is from Babylon. Babylon is the land of, it's actually within the land of Shinar. And there's foreign gods, or God, that they have that's not Yahweh. Everybody with me so far? Makes sense? Okay. Nothing earth-shattering, right? Okay.
Yes.
Babylon, is something we looked at in some detail in the past, is one of the areas where Satan himself has set up as the epicenter of his kingdom. It's in opposition to Jerusalem, which is the capital of God's kingdom. So you have two kingdoms being established. Both are contrary one to the other. Actually, God hasn't begun to establish Jerusalem yet. It doesn't happen until chapter 12 when he begins that process. Right now, though, Satan is setting up a kingdom. Who's the individual who founded that kingdom for Satan?
Nimrod.
Nimrod. Nimrod is a mighty hunter, a fearless hunter in defiance of Yahweh. That's the whole point you have to really get from chapter 10. Nimrod is in defiance of Yahweh. Where does this defiance come to its ultimate fruition with him? In his kingdom. He's a tyrant. He's a leader. He's hunting the souls of men. Well, why would he hunt the souls of men? Doesn't Satan do the same thing? Who's he working for?
Satan.
Or the adversary. So he's just doing what his father before him did. Right? His father before him was a murderer and the father of lies, right? Well, so is Nimrod. He's, the apple didn't fall far from the family tree, so to speak. So Nimrod here is this individual. Now, the word fearless, which is interesting, is the word used of giant and hero in Genesis 6:4. So you could make the idea here that he's fearless, or possibly you could take it this way. Cush fathered Nimrod, or rebellion. Why is he named that? Because Cush's son is the first one to reestablish that link. Everybody with me so far?
No, Nimrod is the first one.
Nimrod. The first one that's a result of the angels which left not their first estate, beginning the rebellion again with man, the post-flood rebellion. Okay? Nimrod is the result of that. And he becomes a tyrannical leader throughout the land. He's in defiance to God, and he now establishes a kingdom. The kingdom has its capital in Babel, which is Babylon, in the land of Shinar. Okay, now let's go to chapter 11.
And look at how
he starts the boat. Go ahead.
Look at how fast that happens, Ollie. His father's on the boat.
His father's on the boat.
Yeah, with a pure line.
With a pure line.
And this is his grandson.
Yep. It is.
I mean, that's what, 20 years? Basically,
which I don't believe Ham did anything wrong in the account speaking of Noah in chapter 9, but it doesn't speak highly of his parental skills.
No!
I mean, you have Canaan and Cush who are in outright rebellion against what God would do. And it kind of tells us a little bit about Ham's thinking. Now, I mean, I can't say that unequivocally. You can be a godly person and have bad kids. You know, people are responsible for their actions. But it kind of makes you wonder.
And that pattern started from the beginning.
Yeah, it did. It was a rebellion that began very quickly after they came off the boat, I believe. Let's go to chapter 11. Again.
Looks like Cain and Abel.
Cain and Abel.
Well, another aspect.
Yeah. Who knows? Maybe as children they weren't instructed. They were, something they never believed in.
Right.
I mean, they were educated in a way that...
That's possible. We don't know, but I mean, that is a possibility.
But in all fairness, that, and we know that from whose mouth's a roaring lion,
right,
Seeking whom he may devour. He had all the ante was on this next move that he was about
sure
to make. He's got everything all spread out now, so it's very hard to see and figure out. Here, he's very overt, very obvious.
Very obvious.
He's going to pick the weak link and he's going for it, just like he did with Eve.
Right.
And he's going to levy all of his educational skills on that child.
That's correct.
And influence him.
And he did a very good job, because obviously we see some things that really become critical to events later on. Chapter 11 of Genesis, again, reading it off of this, verse 1. The whole land had a common language and a common vocabulary. As people migrated westward, they came across a plain in the region of Shinar and settled there.
That's confusing, because I thought we were closer to Jerusalem and not too far from the Mediterranean Sea. This would indicate that they had to be at least 800 miles
well, again,
west.
They migrated
east. You know, they're headed west, back
right.
towards Israel.
Right. Which is why I when we were talking about the Noah's flood, I you can't get hung up on the idea of
worldwide thing.
Right, you can't.
But the ark, the rest of that Ararat, somewhere in Ararat, which is over in Turkey, so they have to go 800 miles back.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, okay, well, there must have been some wayfarers, and I'm sure there was a lot of wanderlust in those days, seeing new things.
The whole point is they're migrating or traveling westward, right? And they come across a plain in the region of Shinar, and they all settle there. Now, verse 3, then they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly. They had brick instead of stone and tar instead of mortar. Then they said, come on, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its summit in the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves so we will not be scattered over the surface of the entire land. Now, back in Genesis 6.
Could I just inject something?
Sure.
When you're talking about bricks, God never builds anything out of a brick. Stone.
Right, it's stone.
Men make things because they're uniform. The socialists make uniformity and, totally different than how God wants to deal with people.
And it's true. In Genesis 6,
Pharaoh made bricks for the children of Israel later on.
Right.
No straw.
Right. It's that uniformity. Cities oftentimes are contrary to God, too. It would be an interesting study in of itself. But back in Genesis 6, you have the giants in verse 4, right? And they're called men of renown. Now, what's that word renown mean? Well, it can mean hero. It can mean giant. What else can it mean?
Men of honor, men of stature.
Men of stature.
They're well, widely known.
Widely known. Isn't that the idea?
Reputation.
Yeah,
reputation.
Yeah.
Right? They want to make themselves a name.
Legend.
That's exactly what they want to do.
As in mythology.
Right. And they don't want to scatter throughout the entire surface of the earth. Or the entire soil or ground.
Why would that even happen? What is the fear of being scattered on the? What is going to scatter them around the earth that would present a problem?
I got a question or an answer for that. You can't be famous if there's nobody.
Well, they should
clap for you or whatever.
It's part of it. You have to get people
in one order alone.
It's
no big deal.
You have to have somebody under you.
You have to have somebody that's creating adulation.
I've never been famous.
Right.
Please just clap for 15 minutes.
You have, the other thing, too, if you got a tape recorder or whatever.
Okay.
The other part of it, too, is it's almost like when you have one person acting alone that's contrary to what everybody else is doing. Everybody looks at that person like a nut job. But when you get a group of people together and you can develop a pack mentality, it makes it easier to establish a rebellion.
Thank you,
there was a famous singer back in the late 60s, early 70s with the band The Doors, Jim Morrison.
Jim Morrison.
Anybody ever heard of him?
Oh, yeah.
He wrote one time that, and he actually tested it, and his test in his mind came true. His test, his thinking was, well, I can incite a group of people by working them into a frenzy to get whatever I want them to do, and I'll incite a riot. And he did. Yeah, just from his music. He
concerts or something?
Yeah. And his idea was to incite riots because he believed that individually people would never do that, but collectively you get a pack mentality that allows people to do things they would never, ever do.
It's like a soccer, those European soccer tournaments. People are always getting killed.
Right, but yet some of those people can be the most peaceful people until they get to this sporting event and become crazed.
That's why there's no new stadium going to be built.
No.
Right? So that's part of the reason as well. It's easier to induce, if your rebellion is to capture the souls of men, to hunt them, to slay the souls of men, like his father, his daddy, your adversary did, then the idea you want to do is to keep everybody together to do so. Easier.
Well, they had to have, that place had to be named Ego City, because most people would just be happy to go out and stake out a claim, like in the Old West, and build a farm, build a family life. You know, nobody's looking to be the big shot.
Right.
You know, but these must have been a bunch of ego maniacs, you know, that's just
they were.
Huge ego maniacs.
They were.
They're
people. Yeah. Hmm?
They
were simply people. But I mean, where did he get all this ego, you know?
Again,
for recognition.
Yeah, I think what it is
opposite
is
of humility.
When you have a lot of people together, it feeds that idea. It feeds the idea of, I don't want to just be one face in a crowd. I want to be someone.
I want to be somebody.
Yeah. Because that idea was.
I want to be me.
So you have that going, and they want to stay riveted in that land. Now the land would be the land of Shinar. Which is where Babel is, which is the capital of
Babylon.
Okay? Verse 5, but Yahweh came down to see the city and the tower that the people had started building. Yahweh said, look, they are one people with the same language. For all of them, and this is only the beginning of what they will do, nothing that they have a mind to do will be impossible for them. In other words, their thoughts were evil continually in Genesis 6, right? All they did was wickedness. That's the same accusation in verse 6 of chapter 11. They all have one language, they all have one mind, and they'll only do the things that they have a mind to do, and it will not be impossible for them to accomplish that goal.
That's a loaded statement, though. Now nothing will be impossible for them.
Mm-hmm. In other words, nothing as far as what they're imagining in a rebellion against me will be impossible for them to do. The other interesting thing that you have here is that the Lord comes down. Why does he come down? Because he has to see for himself exactly what it is that they're doing. Okay? He's coming down to see. What is it that they're building a tower? What is the tower doing? It's reaching up into the heavens, right? Verse 4, its summit in the heavens. It's almost like an oblique sort of an idea, where it goes up and it has the point at the top where it's reaching up into the heavens. Well, why? Because that's where the angelic realm is. They're trying to get back with them. They're trying to have them come down again to begin a rebellion again. This also is the idea, and it entails the idea of the zodiac and things like that is incorporated all into this. Why? Because, again, you have the idea that the stars tell a picture, and they have a religion within that. They corrupt that message. The stars originally in Genesis 1 were given for signs, right? What does that mean? Psalms 19 talks about how the heavens declare God's handiwork. They had a message in the stars, and that message communicated God's revelation to man before there was a written record. This is the corruption of that record. And then you have that rebellion coming on. Now God says in verse 7, come on, let us go down there and confuse their language so that they will not understand each other's speech.
Let us
Yeah, what is us? We took the angels, or who did he take it with?
It's the three people in the Godhead, I believe.
Oh, okay.
Because the word us there is the word Elohim. Okay? That's my thinking. Now, some people may take it as an angelic beings, and angels can sometimes be referred to as Elohim.
That's kind of scary to think God can come down, all three of them.
Yeah.
You don't know where they're going to show up.
You know, there's different ways people look at that, and it can be angelic beings.
Yeah, I tend to look at it as Elohim.
So, I mean, it very easily could be angelic beings, and that would not be a stretch in that passage. What it entails, though, is that Yahweh himself and some other beings are coming with him.
Maybe an archangel?
Could be.
Now, this may be a silly question, but why did he have to come down to see what they were doing?
Well, again, I believe he had to because God is... We always get this idea that God's out of time, and he can look in and see everything. That's not the accurate thing. God is never depicted being outside of time. He's always depicted in it. And there's times that God has to learn something. For instance, he had to learn that Abraham would do all that he said he would. That's why he tested him with Isaac. He doesn't know everything that's... For instance, he can't know everything in the future because the future hasn't happened yet, and God's in time. He can't go back and redo the past. Nowhere do we read that he can, and nowhere do we read that he goes beyond into the future. He's always in the present. He can predict the future, but then sometimes the future doesn't come about because people make a decision to change their course. A case point in that would be the Book of Micah. It's a prophecy about Assyria conquering and destroying Jerusalem, yet Assyria never conquers Jerusalem ever.
Yeah, and Jonah could have gone the same way.
Jonah could have.
You know, had he decided, I am going no matter what you do to me.
Right.
You know, it would have been a different story.
Well, why do you think he's allowed it yet?
Well, again, when you give beings a free will to make decisions.
So why would they have to? Yeah. I mean, I can see a human, but why them?
Well, it goes back to what Paul records for us in Romans 1, that man always will come back and find a way to change the glory of God into an image made like unto corruptible man, and then it begins to degenerate from there. Like the brick. And John brought up a good point. When they're building temples or altars, it's always stones. Yet, when it's man doing something, it's brick. And that's a real, really good point, because they're using bricks here. So God comes down, and he says that he's going to confuse their language so that they cannot understand each other's speech. So, verse 8, so Yahweh scattered them abroad from there over the surface of the entire land so that they had to stop building the city. For that reason, the name of it is Babel, because Yahweh confused the land language of all the land, and from there did Yahweh scatter them abroad on the face of all the land. Now, back in chapter 10, there's an individual that is named Peleg. And Peleg would be in verse 25 of chapter 10. And to Eber were born two sons, the name of one Peleg, for in his days was the land divided, and his brother's name Joktan. Now, I'm going to tell you how I see this idea of the land divided. I believe it was in the time of Peleg that God came down and confused the language. The land is divided according to language, but I also believe it was at that point that he separated the lands as well. North America became North America. South America became South America, not one landmass. I believe both things occurred at that point. It's a division regardless. Definitely a division in language. But God made it impossible for them to all work together again. He confused their language. We have to understand the idea of language here is the idea of judgment. In Isaiah 28, for instance, when Isaiah talks about here a little, there a little, and he gets a line upon line, then he talks with stammering lips while I speak with this generation, right? The idea there is a judgment that's coming. Whenever God talks about tongues, it's a judgment coming. It's not something good. Tongues is evidence that there's a rebellion that God is stopping. In Acts chapter 2, for instance, when they all are filled with the Spirit and they begin to utter new tongues, it's differentiating two groups of people there. Who's it differentiating? The believing Jew and the non-believing Jew. And all the non-believing Gentiles who don't have the gift. And it's a sign that judgment is coming. And they have a year to get things right, and if they don't get it right, then the judgment comes. Hence, in chapter 6 and 7 of the book of Acts, Stephen looks up, sees the Lord standing. Isaiah tells us he stands to plead and to judge. Judgment is coming now, and it begins, and it runs rampant. When the Gentiles begin to speak in tongues, chapter 10 of the book of Acts, it's an indication that the Spirit has left Israel and is now with Gentiles. That's one of the reasons why I believe that the body of Christ began in mid-Acts, not late-Acts. The reason for it was to provoke Israel to jealousy. The Spirit's no longer with them. You've been pronounced under a judgment. What's the judgment? Tongues is the evidence of it.
So the Pentecostal faith is really it's totally invalid.
It totally is. And even in God's own word, tongues are assigned to those who believe not, mm-hmm. not to a believer. So when you look at all this, this all has its roots here. What are they trying to do? To reestablish what was destroyed in Genesis 6, 7, and 8. They begin, it's more regional now. Because the rebellion hadn't reached its fruition yet, because God stopped it before it could. But yet, it's chapter 12 that begins with the call of Abraham. Why does chapter 12 begin with the... Well, chapter 11 ends with us being introduced to the genealogy of Abraham. Chapter 12, and Yahweh said unto Abram, come thou on thy way, out of thy land, out of the place of thy birth, and out of the house of thy father unto the land that I will show thee, that I may make thee a great nation, and bless thee, and make great thy name, and become thou a blessing. That I may bless them who bless thee, but him who maketh light of thee will I curse, so shall be blessed in thee all the families of the ground. The idea here is that Abram is going to be raised up. Why? Well, Satan has a kingdom, and the kingdom is now being established on planet Earth. It has a capital by the name of Babylon, and it's the dominant force now. That religion that was introduced begins to spread, and God's answer to it is to create a nation that will conquer and destroy that epicenter of rebellion against him. Who's the instrument he's going to use? The nation he's going to produce out of Abram. That's what the Tower of Babel is all about. If we can understand that, then it tells us why God created Israel. That's why, for instance, he tells Abram, walk. He wants him to walk up and down the land. Why? Because everywhere his feet touch, it's going to be his. Right? And then later on he tells them the same thing, and he continually expands on that covenant. And what you have is this whole idea that he will conquer the land of Shinar. Now, Shinar isn't just Babel. You have to understand it. It mentioned other places there. Babel is the center, the capital of Shinar. But Babel is the land that Abram has been given to possess. And that's why Abram comes upon the scene.
The land of Canaan.
He's going to conquer all of that territory, that nation. So that's what the Tower of Babel is about, and that's why it's addressed in Genesis. Question from Ohio. Anybody have a comment there?
No. Not at all for me.
Oh, okay. So
we're talking about Genesis 10:10, where it says the beginning of his kingdom was Babel.
Right.
That's just where it started.
It's where it started, and it spread out.
Spread out. Could I just ask a question? You were talking about Cush begat Nimrod.
Mm-hmm.
So Cush begat the rebellion.
I believe so. And Nimrod is the result of that rebellion.
So this is not what you were talking about with demons or fallen angelic realm having sexual relations.
I believe that's the rebellion he introduced.
Cush.
Yep. Well, again, I think it began with him. How will we? We're not told.
At what point did God?
Well, we're not told when he's. Mm-hmm. We're told in Scripture that he was the son of Ham.
That he's the son of Ham. That's correct. But we're not told when he did it or how he did it. What we're told is
because
the result.
Prior to that particular verse, in other words, in verse 7, it talks about the sons of Cush. Not one of them is Nimrod.
No.
Then in verse 8, it says he begat Nimrod.
Right. Right. So I think Nimrod, if we look there, he has what? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Nimrod would be the ninth. And I think he is. I think what it is he begot, he fathered. Another way you could look at it is, let me read it a different way. Cush fathered rebellion, who became the first fearless leader throughout the land. He became a fearless hunter in defiance of Yahweh. That is why it is said, like rebellion, a fearless hunter in defiance of Yahweh. And that would make it Cush. And Nimrod shouldn't be a name, but should be translated. I mean, you could take it there. You know, I tend to take it that Nimrod is a son, the ninth son, the youngest of his. How much time passed, we don't know, but it was long enough for him to have nine sons. He's the youngest son. It could have been well after Canaan, with what occurred with Noah and the cursing of Canaan. It could have been a number of years after that. But it was still within the lifetime of Ham's eldest son. That's how I would see it.
At what point did God incarcerate the wicked spirit?
The ones in Peter?
Yeah.
I believe that was at the flood.
Okay. So he throws a batch in, and then he gives another batch, and he has to deal with it again?
Yeah, I believe so.
Because you deal with it again.
Yeah.
Going into the promised land, God said, kill them all.
Yeah, kill them all.
Kill them all. Yeah. They were perverted by the, you know, the Goliath, if you want to say.
Right.
And they didn't do that. So my question is, I don't think there's an answer to this, but the Israelites did not kill them.
Right.
So where are they now?
Well, again, I believe, and this is just my belief because we're not told, at least not to my knowledge. We might be. I haven't figured it out if we are, though. I believe that there is still within the genetic code of some people the seeds of that rebellion.
I believe.
Now?
Yeah.
So
a room of 100 people, there could be one.
And I think we've seen some of those people, because I think they would be the people that we would look at and say that they're so evil. I think they would be the sociopath.
How about the ISIS?
At least it's leaders. But I do believe that there is still that genetic makeup within certain individuals. Created the
nation.
They got a lot of them, though. They did a pretty good job, but it wasn't complete.
It wasn't all of them.
Like the Amalekites, right. Saul was sent, commissioned, to exterminate every last one. So what does he do?
Yeah.
Had they not dropped the bomb on Japan, it would have been a totally different picture.
Yeah, but the end result is at some point it's going to be there.
Eventually the thing repeated itself.
Right.
You know, you still have trouble.
Right.
It didn't put an end to wars,
no.
But at that time it allowed peace to happen for a time and repentance of nations for what they had done and people to look back and see the evil that
right.
they were following.
Right.
So the Japanese people are basically a respectful people, and this group mentality turned them into monsters.
It
did. And that's what military does. You have to have that collective thinking, kill.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's like, I came back from Vietnam all messed up because that's not what they want to do.
No, nobody wants to.
You know?
Nobody's saying that.
And even the enemy, they don't want to do it either. They're just told, here, kill.
Right.
You know,
I think we've got to do something totally different here with ISIS and all this. I think it's about the Jew.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's about God.
Mm-hmm.
And this has to play out. And it's going to play out. I don't think the United States, no matter what we would do,
right.
is going to alter that.
Which goes back to what I said. I think it doesn't really matter what the United States
does. No,
done.
It doesn't. I don't believe it does.
Yeah.
I really don't. I mean, we've been over there now for 14 years. All we've managed to do is kill a lot of kids.
Right.
And
breed more hatred against them.
More hatred, and I think this is, here we're talking about the evil that is in, however you want to put it, with the genetic makeup of the Arab world, and it's just there.
It is.
And we're not going to placate them. Obama says we're going to give them jobs, going to educate them or something, and they won't hate us anymore. It's in there.
That's how I look at it. So to answer your question, Ted, I guess I would say it really doesn't matter what the U.S. does.
It's not going to work.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't see the believer really, the believer today having subjection to the government of this country. Now, we're to live peaceable and quiet lives.
Right.
You know, we're to do good works towards all men. We're to just treat people the way God would want us to treat them. But having said that, it's not up to us as believers to stop ISIS or groups like that. That's just my opinion.
Oh, that's good. Thanks.
Oh, you're welcome.
The rest of the world is out here.
Sure.
And
it's regional.
Prophecy is just regional.
It is.
You read the book of Revelation.
It's regional.
U.S. isn't mentioned, is it?
No.
You know, it's totally regional.
And it's interesting because a lot of the words in the book of Revelation have that idea with it. It's not, for instance, it's not typically the word Gehei, which is referenced, or it's Gehei that's mentioned as opposed to cosmos, land. I can't pronounce the other word and I butcher it. But there's another word that's translated world, and that literally means a geographic region.
Mm-hmm.
And that's referenced a number of times in the book of Revelation as well. So that's kind of how I would see it, though. I just want to end with one last thought, and that's that the earth was divided, and the great division between mankind is the result of language. And language really has come to define cultures and their thinking as well. For instance, in the United States, we have a certain culture, but it's all based off of the fact that we have a common language. Our common language came from England, predominantly. And we have that way of thinking in our culture. There's some differences, but overall, we would be pretty much in agreement on most issues with our society. Another country, for instance, speaks Swahili. And their culture is radically different than ours. And again, it's based off of the idea that they have a language that allows them to communicate and to develop a uniqueness within their society. And I believe that these beings that have come into existence, whose genetic code is still within some men, they have a language as well. And the attempt was to continually have that one language. And that's the problem with things like the UN. It's the idea of bringing everybody back together again to create a commonality in society. Because once that occurs, it allows a rebellion to take off again. And I believe God prevented that rebellion by making it impossible for man to do that through these languages and to create geographical barriers as a result of that. So it's a good place to end, I think. Any questions? Did it make sense? Okay. Do you understand maybe Tower of Babel a little better than before?
Mm-hmm. The reason behind it.
Yeah. I mean, that's why there's quite a bit said in those couple of chapters. You know, it's a pivotal moment in the history of man.
I wonder how high they were able to build it. If they didn't have scaffolding like they do now.
Yeah,
they had stuff.
But, I mean, they didn't have those big high things.
And they did it in a circle.
Yeah.
And a lot of people. Interesting little sidebar here. During the process of building the new, I don't know what you call it, like the capital of Europe, and the architect designed it, and it looks just like it is the Tower of Babel.
It is.
They're all going off.
It's circular. It's spiral. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if they'll ever build it. But they're working on it. When will they ever learn?
They won't. not until later. Any questions from the folks in Ohio?
No, not for me. Very interesting. That was also an interesting point as to why they were building that tower to begin with. That was a good point you made about trying to reach the angels and to have the angels come down and stir up another rebellion and so forth. I never thought of that. That's still a lot of these things. A lot of good points. Thank you very much.
Well, good. Well, on that note, we'll say goodnight to you folks in Ohio, and we'll be with you next Thursday.
Okay.
Very good. Good night, everyone.
Good night, guys.
Good night.
Stay warm. Bye.
Try and stay warm. It's pretty cold.